Back in seminary, I was a real social justice activist, and very little has changed since then. No sooner did I enter PSR than I helped to organize Transformation, a student group for trans students to begin to address what we felt were inequities in school policy. I was also invited to sit on the Trans Task Force, a consortium of faculty, staff, and student representatives that more directly interfaced with the administration in addressing concerns. At the end of that first semester, I spent a charming night in Santa Rita Jail for my role as a GTU protest chaplain, helping to keep things peaceful as protesters shut down the I-80 freeway following the Michael Brown verdict. I also took part in subsequent protests. The next year, in addition to continuing my work with Transformation and the Trans Task Force, I was also very involved with the Standing Rock issue, making two trips to the area with contingents of GTU students. And more locally, I also participated in protests against the canonization of Junipero Serra, including demonstrations at Mission Dolores in San Francisco. Subsequently, I was also involved in the campaign to defeat PSR's plan to sell most of its campus to Mather Lifeways, an organization which, in building a huge high-end retirement community, would have architecturally and ecologically destroyed the entire nature of Holy Hill. I joined and worked with Save Holy Hill, a group of PSR neighbors and students and concerned Berkeley citizens. And the social and political action, we were instrumental in helping to elect a slate of municipal candidates that did not favor the continuation of the pro-development policies that were transforming Berkeley from a small activist college town into a corporatopolis. Through our efforts, the company finally pulled out of the project. And in my final year of seminary, I attended several counter-protests to protest against the alt-right activities and demonstrations. In other words, I was a social justice warrior on fire. However, amid all this good work, I did make one error in judgment, and it was a bad one. Oh, my. I'd been involved in chapel service planning ever since my first semester, and gradually began to bother me more and more that some aspects of the student population were not represented in our chapel services. In particular, I saw no services that in any way involved the large Korean population of the student body or any other Asian groups. Similarly, Native students were liturgically and sometimes unrepresentative, as were Latinx. There was much talk about decolonization of the chapel, and as far as it involved the African-American student population, this was actively being done as part of the Black Lives Matter movement, but not so with other marginalized communities. I mentioned this during one of our planning meetings because I wanted equality for everyone, not stopping to think that it happened to be Black History Month. Audible sigh. And either due to not expressing myself as clearly, as articulately as I might have wanted to, or the way I said it, somehow my call for less whiteness in the chapel was interpreted by the several African-American students on the committee as a call for less blackness. And it spread throughout the entire school. This in turn led to a special meeting addressing the issue to which the entire school was invited. Talk about being embarrassed, because everyone knew whose fault it was. And it was all due not to bad intention, but to an ill-considered use of the tongue. And I think this is what James is addressing in our passage from his epistle this week. He leads off by saying that all people make mistakes, and, well, perhaps, like the rest of us, he'd made a doozy or two in his time. through the simile of a ship, which however large is guided by means of a comparatively small rudder, he exemplifies the large effect that our relatively small tongue can have on those around us. Their tongues are capable of helping to bring people closer, of aiding healing, of expressing love and caring, but are also able to cause great harm, dividing people and even leading to wars. James says that the tongue cannot be tamed, and though sometimes it speaks with good intent, all too often its purpose is to sow discord, to speak with venom, and sometimes in the same breath, to both bless and curse. Now, while I am circumspect in criticizing he who is traditionally considered to be the brother of Jesus, and I grant the validity of his argument on the effect of the tongue, I feel that there is hope in our learning to use it more wisely. In considering the wise use of the tongue, we can't help but think of Solomon, who has figured in our lectionary in the last few weeks. For when asked by God what he wished for, the young ruler who had just succeeded his father, King David, had the innate wisdom to look beyond his own self-interest. For no matter how long his life, how full his coffers, or how many of his enemies God mowed down for him, without the abilities he would need to effectively rule the tenuously united kingdom of Israel and Judah, it would fall. And so, very cannily, he asked for the very thing he would need, a wise understanding and discerning mind. And as he well demonstrated, that would require a wise use of the tongue all throughout his reign. And it requires something else, I think, that both precedes, shall we call it lingual wisdom, and also results from it. For from what we know of Solomon, others like him in Scripture, personal advantage is not at the heart of their motivation. Rather, they are those remarkable individuals, and even rarer rulers, who actually put the good of others before their own and speak and act from that basis. So important, yet underrated, is acting and speaking with wisdom that the Greeks named it Sophia, the feminine aspect of God. As such, it identifies the vital quality of compassion so necessary among other abilities, not only in leadership, but all throughout human endeavors and interactions. This is also addressed in our reading from Proverbs, in which wisdom is similarly personified. And this needs just a little bit of backstory. In an excerpt from Proverbs that appeared in the lectionary a few weeks ago, Lady Wisdom is established and shows herself to be truly wise, leading by example to demonstrate that truism is not merely a thing of public displays of demonstrably wise behavior, but must be carefully cultivated. And so it is that she built her house with a firm foundation, well supported by seven pillars. She also set a well-laden table, realizing that wisdom must be well sustained and supported once established. For only by being grounded and nourished in spirit and body can one have the strength and courage to leave behind the things that don't truly serve the course of wisdom and true perception and carefully cultivate those that do. She is, in essence, telling us, and these might be the most important words that I say today, to wake up! And she continues in this work in this week's passage, crying out on the busiest street corners, "How long, O simple ones, will you love being simple? How long will you fools hate knowledge?" But she means this lovingly. Not because she truly believes that we are incapable of change and deserve to be punished for our iniquity, but in frustration because she knows we are capable of so much more. And so it is that she pours out her thoughts, her words, and her love to us. Yet true wisdom is more than choosing right behavior that will support the greatest good of all. An observation that seems very much in keeping with our reading from Proverbs. Rather, in addition to wise acts and altruistic motivation, it is to realize and honor the divine source of that wisdom, as Solomon did, and be willing to answer when God calls. There is, however, if I might coin a term, something a little anti-wisdomic element in all of this, and one that can easily trip us up. It is all too easy to put all our focus on the wisdom of the ancients in sacred texts that were written hundreds or even thousands of years ago. To be sure, it is there and it continues to be a valuable source of guidance. But that is not the only place it is. It exists in the works, the words, and the actions of theologians, philosophers, futurists, and other great thinkers of all traditions, nations, and cultures through the centuries and into and beyond our postmodern age. So true is this that we might do well to consider reopening the canon rather than cutting off our primary spiritual resources with the First Council of Nicaea in the 4th century. However, in so considering, we would also need to expand both our thinking and our spiritual conception of faith beyond the traditional parameters of Christianity and Christendom. True wisdom is that expansive and all-encompassing. But no matter what we do, wisdom is of little use beyond an intellectual exercise if it remains within a book or a seminary or an iPad. That is merely knowledge which is often content to sit upon the laurels of its own self-importance. It only becomes wisdom when it is put into our vocabulary, when it is put into action. Wisdom has been needed in all ages. In our society and in our personal lives, but never more so than now. We live in a world of exponentially evolving technology with the power to provide great benefit or do incredibly great harm. We play at this time, in this place, with dangerous toys. So yes, we are in need of wisdom and discernment in our thinking, in interpreting our feelings, whether we act on them in carefully considered response rather than knee-jerk reaction, and in our subsequent actions. You know, while I sometimes choose not to be political in the pulpit, lest I undermine my message and do a disservice to the sacred and my charge in spiritual community. However, there are other times where it seems that I am not following God's call unless I do precisely that. We are people of faith, and we are called to action. Otherwise, why are we here in the thick of the world? Were it simply to work on our own spiritual perfection until we float up into the sky on the day of the rapture, we could do that sitting in a cave somewhere, or cloistered away in a monastery or a convent. And much akin to Carl Sagan's response when asked by a reporter if he thought there was life on other worlds, and his response, well, if there's not, seems like an incredible waste of space. It seems that our doing so would be, our secreting ourselves away and not being involved would be a tremendous waste of real estate. We were meant to be caretakers of the earth, to work together in harmony for the good of the planet, for the health of human community and in faithful relationship with God and one another as God's children. There are a number of scientists that say it's too late, that we're beyond the point where we can reverse the effects of global warming and other ways we have seriously injured the planet. And they have plenty of credible scientific evidence to back themselves up. However, in keeping with the nature of scientific debate, there are many other scientists who believe we're not quite yet at that tipping point, but we soon will be if we don't act soon. The planet has a tremendous God-given ability to heal itself, but it can only be pushed so far, and it needs our help. We are the hands and the feet of God if we are willing to be. There's that free will thing again. And we have the choice to speak with her voice rather than our own. As in every age, there are those who say that the world is going to hell in a handbasket. And with perhaps the distinct difference that in our age, things are moving so fast that we tend to keep making bigger handbaskets so the problem doesn't look as bad. Again, is it too late? Are we so messed up now that we can't do the work, God's work, that she would have us do? I don't think so, and neither, I think, do you. We can do it, but we need to start now. Are you with me? It may be that some of us will be called to work that looms large in the world, with great booming voices that come from every television set and radio and computer. While others' work may be more grassroots in small community or even family or individual effort. But the important thing is that we step forward with a willing hand, a faithful heart, and a true voice when called. For even the smallest word and act may play a larger part in aggregate than any of us can possibly realize. Now is the time, and the time is now. Amen.